From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, election victory and controversy for Israel's Netanyahu, a museum massacre in Tunisia, GOP budgets, a bloody arrest at the University of Virginia. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu won a tough election in Israel. He courted conservative voters before the polling appeared to say no to a two-state solution.
So if you are prime minister, a Palestinian state will not be formed?
Indeed.
Post-vote, he looked to soften that, but there is talk of reassessing the Israel relationship in Washington. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest yesterday.
Words matter. And that is certainly true in this instance.
And a black UVA honors student, bloodied during an arrest, needed 10 stitches. Thousands of UVA students rallied around him. Race and police action on the table again.
You could be at the number one university in Virginia, and you could be a model student on the honor committee or anything like that, and you could still be brutalized by the police.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Yoki Driesen of Foreign Policy, Rachel Smolkin of CNN, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where do the U.S. and Israel go now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington, Yoki Driesen, managing editor for news at Foreign Policy. Yoki, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
With us from Washington as well, Rachel Smolkin, executive editor for CNN Politics. Rachel, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Yoki, and Rachel.
Let's listen to just a little bit of Benjamin Netanyahu. This was talking with NPR's Steve Inskeep yesterday, looking to walk back from what appeared to be a real challenge to a fundamental U.S. position and longtime Israel formal position on a two-state solution. Here he is with Inskeep yesterday.
I said that I don't think that these things hold today, but I think the conditions have to change. You know, I don't want a one-state solution, but I certainly don't want a zero-state solution, a no-state solution, where Israel's very existence would be jeopardized. And that's what the people of Israel overwhelmingly elected me to do.
Softening what appeared to be a big reach for conservative votes on the eve of the election. And the full statement from Josh Earnest here, a little more detail, him saying words matter. There's a lot of talk of some kind of reevaluation here.
Words matter. And that is certainly true in this instance. And because of his pretty clear indication that he's prepared to withdraw from very serious commitments that Israel had previously made to a two-state solution, that does and has prompted us to reevaluate our approach to this matter.
Yoki Driesen, first of all, where do you see Benjamin Netanyahu actually standing as the dust settles on these two rounds of statements on a two-state solution? And what about the U.S.-Israel relationship?
You know, Tom, it's interesting. What you had here, not to be overly glib, but you had a flip-flop from Netanyahu. I mean, remember that in 2009, he broke with decades of where his own party had been and said he could support a Palestinian state. Flash forward, last week he said he would not in the clips that you played. Then yesterday he again said he could, which no one buys at this point. I mean, what was clear from the White House comments, both on the record in the readout, the sort of emailed account that they send around, and also just the background calls they did yesterday, is that they're not buying it, that they don't see this new attempt to walk back, his previous attempt to walk back, his previous attempt as anything that holds water. We broke a story this week on how the White House, which is now completely fed up and distrustful of where Netanyahu is on a Palestinian state, is willing for the first time to allow through a Security Council resolution at the United Nations, basically designed to force Israel to a deal. This is the type of resolution that this White House, like its predecessors, had vetoed for decades. And the fact that the White House is very seriously considering allowing it through is a tangible sign of just how much anger they have and just how much this distrust they have of this leader that they've now been fighting with for the entirety of Obama's term in office.
Rachel Smolkin, we saw Benjamin Netanyahu working with politics in Israel. How does this play out politically in this country? Can the White House stick with the position that would be in opposition to Israel's desires? I'm seeing as we speak here that John Boehner, Speaker Boehner, has just announced plans to travel to Israel during the congressional recess later this month. It's a big political football. Well, can the White House hang tough on this if they're not on the same page as Netanyahu on a two-state solution?
We've really seen the relationship between the United States and Israel become partisan. That's very rare. We haven't seen that certainly in recent times to this degree at all. Boehner going over there, as you said, that's just been confirmed by his office. And the Obama administration, their attitude toward Netanyahu turning into outright hostility this week. It's moved way past frustration, which we've seen simmering over many weeks and months with Obama. Now, President Obama has made the congratulatory phone call to Netanyahu. That took 2 full days after the election. And even that call, which was, you know, ostensibly to congratulate him, ended up being this very firm warning from the White House, from President himself, that the United States would, quote, reassess aspects of its relationship. So really striking deterioration of the relationship.
And it wasn't just the two-state solution issue. As big as that is, that's been a cornerstone for years and years. Also, Netanyahu's warning to Israeli voters before the vote that Arab voters were turning out in droves. It was seen as a, what it's been called, a southern strategy or dog whistle. Come out here, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest talking about that as well yesterday, saying he was troubled by that attempt to get his supporters to vote by warning of Arab voters turning out in droves. Here's Earnest.
That cynical election day tactic was a pretty transparent effort to marginalize Arab-Israeli citizens and their right to participate in their democracy.
Jack Beatty, with that, we have two big things on the table here. One, the vision of peace that successive American presidencies, administrations, Republican and Democratic, have worked for many years. Also, going right to the issue of Israeli democracy itself being voiced here, questions by the White House spokesman. Where does this leave this relationship in your view, Jack?
Well, I agree with the other commentators. It's a bad moment for U.S.-Israel relations. And, you know, suggestions are being made about what we might do at the U.N., what we might do about loan guarantees that could help perhaps stop the settlement movement or at least stop funding it. But there definitely is a crossroads there. You know, but look behind this. I mean, President, the Netanyahu victory is a statement about the Israeli populace as well. And what's the key thing there? Fear. I mean, he won this on security. And what does Israel have to be afraid of? Well, the memoirist Ari Shavit, the Israeli journalist, says in the 21st century, there's no other nation that's occupying another nation, another people, as we do. And there's no other nation that's as frightened, as intimidated as we are. He sees concentric circles of threat closing in on the Jewish state, ranging from the giant circle of 1.5 billion Muslims that surround Israel to the 370 million Arabs immediately around it, to the 10 million Palestinians, the Palestinians within. The point is, that fear is a real political force, and nothing is going to change that. And if anything, that's all going to get worse. Netanyahu said, we can't really do anything on the two-state solution until conditions change. One of the conditions, Iran. Another condition, ISIS and rampant Islamist threat. The point is, it is a reflection of where that country is today. And we can condemn Mr. Netanyahu all we want, but we have to recognize that he reflects something real in his own people.
No question about that. But Yoki, look forward in this relationship again. We've got Tom Friedman writing this week, and this is before Netanyahu tried to walk it back a little bit. But as you say, the White House not buying that walk back. Friedman writing the New York Times op-ed page, Netanyahu will be the father of the one-state solution, and the one-state solution means Israel will become in time either a non-Jewish democracy or a Jewish non-democracy. Do you agree, Yochi? And how does that line up with an American alliance?
You know, I think Jack's point from a moment ago about how Netanyahu reflects his country is absolutely crucial, because there are more and more voices within Israel, and you saw this in this election, as Netanyahu and some of the other right-wing parties were fighting for the same votes, of people saying, if given the choice, if the choice is a Jewish country or a democratic country, you had more than one prominent leader say, better that it be a Jewish country. So for the first time, you're hearing voices within Israel begin, and these are on the margin, this is not a majority, this is not where the country is, but you do have prominent people saying something that would have been unsayable a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that it might be okay to accept a less democratic state, provided that it be a majority Jewish state.
But that's my question. How does that affect the relationship with the United States if it emerges, as Friedman, you know, sees as the big fork in the road here, is not a democracy ultimately?
I think that if it gets to that point, you would have multiple areas in which a relationship with the U.S. would plummet. One, the movement to boycott Israeli institutions, to boycott Israeli companies, which is rapidly gaining steam in Europe, would gain steam here. The movement to sanction Israel, which Congress has so far protected, at some point, even a Republican Congress would move away from. You know, fundamentally, and this was a case that many Israeli voters weighed as they were deciding who to vote for, many pollsters misread it. Many pollsters thought there would be a tie or Netanyahu lost because of this issue. The only relationship that matters for Israel, the only one, is with the United States. It is the biggest protector at the UN, biggest supplier of weaponry, biggest supplier of financial aid. And if that relationship gets poisoned, and it will get poisoned if you have, as we've talked about, if you have a state that becomes less democratic, that is when it becomes more of an existential threat to Israel than anything else that Israel is now worried about, including Iran.
Rachel, I'm trying to imagine how this plays out in the 2016 American presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton, traditionally very strong supporter of Israel, but here she is with her Democratic president in the White House right now, looking at this gulf opening up.
That's right, and we are already seeing partisan divide on this issue. I do think it's important, though, as much as we're noting that Republicans are going after President Obama on this, and we just saw Marco Rubio come out on this, and that there is this split, it's important that we not get past where we are right now in both the politics and the policy, that U.S. officials and members of Congress have noted that tensions won't lead to any cuts in massive security aid packages. So that's where we are right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Netanyahu's controversial victory in Israel, Tunisia attack, Yemen attack today. Reports now of maybe 120 killed in the bombing in mosques in Yemen. Republican budget, Secret Service accountability, the UVA arrest. We'll look at all that with Yoki Driesen, managing editor for news at Foreign Policy Magazine. Rachel Smolkin, executive editor of CNN Politics. Jack Beatty is with us as well, and you can join us. Yoki, Rachel, Jack, let me go to our listeners. Susan in Newton, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question really is this. Words do matter, and what would be the nature of a Palestinian state that would be established? Would it live in peace with Jews and Arabs? Would Jews be welcome in the Palestinian state? Unfortunately, it seems what's coming from the Palestinian media, it seems that the answer to that question is no.
But if you go down this path, where does this lead that we seem to be on right now, Susan? Do the U.S. and Israel stick together, and does Israel remain a democracy?
Well, what I'd really like to see is for people to stay where they are, redraw the boundaries, and let Jews live in a Palestinian state, let Arabs live in a Jewish state, and maybe some sort of federation where they cooperate on security and water issues. But even before you get to that point, the Palestinians themselves haven't decided on who's governing them. Fatah and Hamas, really, they have a unity government, but they're not really functioning together.
Susan, I appreciate your call. Yoki Driesen, for a long, long time, the vision was get this done, and then with economic support and more, things will work themselves out because it's the only way. It's the only way to peace here, and it's the only way to sustain a democracy in Israel and kind of a viable region. Does that still hold, Yoki?
No, I don't think it does. I think that you have a lot of Israelis who will say, we have no terror attacks within Israel. We feel very safe. In terms of the Palestinian issue, we can live this way indefinitely. The demographic issue is far enough in the future that people don't feel it in the moment. It's worth, Susan made a couple of points that it's worth noting that they're true. You know, Bibi may be a very flawed leader. He may be someone who lies, like all politicians. He may be cynical. There's a lot about him to dislike or criticize. But he's not wrong to say that the Palestinians are divided between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. He's not wrong to say that borders of Israel that have been quiet for decades, particularly its northern border with Syria, is no longer quiet. He is not wrong to say the Islamic State now threatens Jordan. So when he's making the case to his own country, he's saying things and doing things that many here, many listeners, many at the White House would find reprehensible. But in the substance of what he says about the threats to Israel on the security front, He's not making those up. Those are real and those are legitimate.
Roy in Atlanta, Georgia. Roy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Even more important to me than the two-state solution issue, I think those words of prejudice, I want to know how that's going to play out with our right wing, because they work so hard to say, you know, the prejudice and the bigotry is in our past, and yet how can you cotton to a prime minister when he says something like this? I mean, to me, as a black American, I just find those very disturbing.
You mean where he's saying, come out and vote because the Arabs are voting in droves?
Yes. They are the others. They are them. They're going to come out to vote. Like, they're not with us. Either we're all Israelis, they're citizens, or they're not. And, I mean, that's terrible to me. How is Boehner and Mitchell and McConnell, how are they going to deal with that? Because that's unquestionably, we're for Israel. But if you have a bad prime minister, we can sometimes, you know, stand off a little bit.
Roy, I appreciate your call. Rachel Smolkin. The appeal has always been we share the same ideals. In that moment, the way that was used, now look, it's been practiced in the United States, Southern strategy and all the rest. But in that moment, it looked like something else. What about Republicans and Democrats now handling what's become a hot potato here?
A hot potato is a perfect way to describe it. I just pulled up the quote we were discussing earlier from Marco Rubio, who said, this president is making a historic mistake. So usually you see Republicans criticizing Democrats and vice versa on domestic policy. That is very common. It's much more rare to have such outright criticism on foreign policy. Obviously, with such things as the war in Iraq, we have seen it. But on Israel, just such a departure from what we've seen in the past. I can't emphasize that enough. He said a historic and tragic mistake. Rubio did go on to say he would make the same criticism if it were a Republican president. But the fact of the matter is that President Obama is in office right now, and we are seeing quite a striking divide on this
issue.
But
Roy in Atlanta looks at these comments before the election when Netanyahu wasn't sure how it would go and appeared to have been in trouble at some point. Roy sees bigotry. Now, I don't know if that's going to become the storyline here. Netanyahu himself says, no, that's not what I meant. But if that's the way it gets interpreted, is it a problem for American conservatives, or do they, you know, brush past that, Rachel?
They're certainly going to push back on that idea, as we've seen so far. It's a risk. I mean, I think there's a risk in both questions, the question of whether it is interpreted as bigotry and the question of whether there's a split with the president, the commander-in-chief, on a major foreign policy issue with a very close ally, or at least what's always been characterized that way.
We've got this tough news out of Yemen today. It is a rough region these days. Words of more beheadings by the Islamic State, this time of Kurds. Big bombing in Yemen, maybe more than 100 killed there in mosques. Of course, on Wednesday, we had gunmen going into Tunisia's National Museum right by the parliament there, killing 19 people, including 17 foreign tourists. Here was the Tunisian Prime Minister, Habib Assid, saying Tunisians would stand together against the attack on their country's vital tourism industry.
Prime Minister Habib Assid said all Tunisians should be united after this attack, which he said was designed to destroy Tunisia's economy.
And this moving moment, while the attack was underway during a siege and lockdown, parliamentarians broke into song, singing the national anthem in Tunisia. Yoki, what about the strikes that we're seeing this week? Number one, do you believe it was ISIS or the Islamic State in Tunisia? And now we've got Yemen as well. What are we seeing here? A real move into North Africa and the Southern Arabian Peninsula? Propaganda strikes? 120 people looks like more than propaganda. That's the death toll in Yemen.
You know, Tom, I think that these are terrifying in many ways, but in two fundamental ways that potentially are different and each scary in its own way. In Iraq, where I lived from 2003 to about 2005 and have spent a lot of time since, the strategy that the al-Qaeda affiliate there had was stoke a civil war by bombing Shiite mosques, Shiite schools, Shiite markets again and again and again until you have Shiites say enough and they start killing Sunnis in return. And if you see in Yemen a sustained campaign by a Sunni militant group to again attack Shiite groups to try to spark a civil war, that's a very scary reprise of a nightmare in Iraq that bedevils us even now. In Tunisia, If it is the Islamic State carrying it out, it's very scary because it suggests their reach goes further than we thought. But if it wasn't the Islamic State, it's scary also, because that would mean that many militants all over the world feel like the best way for them to sort of build their brand, you know, again, not to be glib, but the best way for them to get onto the stage of the world media is to say, we are part of the Islamic State, that for the Islamic State, they have the ability to claim these attacks and people will believe them. So you have this struggle between the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda for influence, for predominance over disparate militant groups all over the world. Al-Qaeda had been the top brand for more than a decade. The Islamic State is now replacing them. And that's scary, even if they were not directly responsible for this attack.
And everything getting wrapped in here, every incident seems that lately a claim by the Islamic State that it's theirs. Meanwhile, the White House trying to negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran over congressional opposition from Republicans there. President Obama released a video yesterday greetings to Iran for Nowruz, the Persian New Year celebration. Spoke directly in the video to Iran's young people, saying a nuclear negotiation could open the way to a far larger U.S.-Iran relationship.
Iran's leaders have a choice between two paths. If they cannot agree to a reasonable deal, they will keep Iran on the path it's on today, a path that has isolated Iran and the Iranian people from so much of the world, caused so much hardship for Iranian families, and deprived so many young Iranians the jobs and opportunities they deserve.
The president of the United States speaking directly to Iranians there. Rachel Smolkin, there has been an appeal from the White House to Republicans on Capitol Hill not to have any vote against this deal until the deal is done, if it can be done, and that's not entirely clear. Now, there appears to be movement on that today, maybe an April 14th vote. But does that mean the deal would be hypothetically done by then, or is there still a move to vote before it even gets to that stage, Rachel?
Well, that's still very fluid. We've been discussing the partisan split on foreign policy. This is another great example. And, of course, an issue that Netanyahu has played a very active role in as well. Negotiations have been ongoing. A group of 47 Republican senators signed a letter to Iran's leaders, written, interestingly, by freshman Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. And that stressed any agreement the Obama administration reached with Iran would require Senate approval. So a real move to undermine the president here. Republicans see this as, in their view, another executive power grab from the president that goes beyond the scope of his authority.
Jack Beatty, what a split here. A split, perhaps a partisan split on Israel. We'll see how that plays out. On Iran, I mean, a whole region here where the U.S. position is becoming hard to understand as polarities open wider and wider in Washington.
Yes, and this was spoken to by General Dempsey and Secretary Kerry in their recent testimony. They said, you know, and this was when they were asking the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for a new authority to prosecute the war against ISIS. And they were saying that it would send a signal if our government were united, if the Republican Congress could say, yes, we support your policy. It would send a signal to our own people out there doing the hard work that we're behind you. It would send a signal to our enemies that we're united. Alas, that's not going to be forthcoming, apparently, that, or at least for a while, that resolution. And in the broader sense, no one can believe that the American government or that America speaks with one voice about any of these. There is a Republican voice and there is the incumbent Democratic president's voice, and the two do not meet, clash again and again.
Meanwhile, back home, same can be said of budget planning and talk this week. Republicans out with the budget plans, a Senate plan, a House plan. They don't exactly line up, but both would bring big cuts in the coming years. Both say they would go to something like a balanced budget, though you've got some math in there that deserves some study. Talking with Fox and Friends on Tuesday, here's Republican Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin saying the budgets Congress is putting forth, the GOP, entail a different vision for the USA.
We just don't think that borrowing, taxing, spending, and regulating is the path to prosperity. If it worked already, we would have much better job growth. We wouldn't have such high poverty rates. This is a plan to balance the budget without raising taxes and give our children a debt-free future. That's how you produce a healthy economy. And the House Republicans are well on their way to passing, for the fifth year in a row, a balanced budget.
Rachel, is it clear that Republicans are on the same page and will come up with a budget? There's been, among other things, dissent over defense spending between budget hawks and military hawks in the GOP ranks.
That's right. Speaker John Boehner is looking at another fight again within his own party, having some trouble corralling his own House Republicans on this. Senator McConnell had said when the Republicans took over the entire Congress that they would run a more productive Senate than had been the case in the past. We're seeing some troubles with that in both chambers. So the budget is an opportunity for that to play out and see how Republicans are able to resolve it. We are having seeing a fight that Boehner is mediating between the defense hawks who want more Pentagon money in the budget resolution and the fiscal hawks who say, no, we need to rein in that government spending across the board for all agencies. So that's the latest. It's important to remember the budget is non-binding. It is symbolic. This is not a shutdown situation. But if Boehner can't get a budget, that is a big embarrassment and a big setback to his ability to run his House Republicans.
Non-binding, but it's also a kind of roadmap. Jack Beatty, when you look at these numbers, do they support Paul Ryan's assertion there that it gets to a balanced budget in a way that adds up?
Only if you blind yourself to what Paul Krugman this morning, I think, rightly calls raw fiscal dishonesty here. I mean, they say they're going to repeal the
Affordable
Care Act, yes, over the next 10 years. That would raise in federal revenue $1 trillion over the next 10 years, so that if you eliminate the program, you would eliminate the trillion and the deficit would be that much bigger. No, they might want to eliminate the program, but keep counting the trillion. I mean, that's just
which would not show up if the program went away. I mean, those are revenues that come directly out of the Affordable Care Act.
Exactly. It's flim-flam. They also want to score this. That is, you know, how will our budget, what kind of economic growth will we have, and what will that contribute to lowering the deficit? They want to use dynamic scoring that posits, it'll really be great. It'll knock $147 billion out of that. And that's, you know, one Republican said this, Ken Buck of Colorado, he said, I don't know anyone who believes we're going to balance the budget in 10 years. It's all hooey. Well, that's on one side. And then on the programmatic side, they want to cut $900 billion over a decade out of Medicaid. They want to, and in eliminating the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid extension in it, that would cost health insurance for 37 million people. They would lose the insurance. They want to cut back on food stamps, on job training, on you name it, and they want to cut it. And their vision is that somehow the road to prosperity for the United States is to just stop spending on all these programs. The president comes back and he says, no, middle-class economics requires what he calls investments, and the Republicans are quick to say that means taxes, in education or infrastructure or research and all the rest. And so you have the fundamental clash of vision and values in foreign policy is replicated in the clash over these budgets.
Here's the president on exactly that point in Cleveland on Wednesday.
The rhetoric doesn't match the reality. The walk doesn't sync up with the talk. And all you have to do is look at the budget that House Republicans put forward just yesterday. It's a budget that doesn't just fail to embrace middle-class economics. It's the opposite of middle-class economics. Doubles down on trickle-down.
Doubling down on trickle-down. Rachel, with the 2016 campaign ahead of us right now, who seems to have the stronger selling message when it comes to budget and spending?
The economy is doing much better, so that helps the Democrats some. Obviously, Republicans are going to push back hard on that one.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, murder mystery, millionaire real estate heir, and HBO subject Robert Durst now faces charges of murder in the deaths of a close friend and his first wife. He was arrested the day after the finale of The Jinx on HBO. He's caught seeming to confess off camera, muttering to himself with the microphone on.
Kill them all, of course.
Kill them all, of course. Okay, March Madness begins. Underdog Hampton faced tourney favorite Kentucky in the first game Thursday night. Head coach Edward Joyner pulled out his cell phone at a pregame press conference and joked about calling Jesus.
Hey, Jesus, they want to know how much of a mountain and what our odds are. Hello? Hello? I guess he'll get back to me, so I'll get back to you, but it's a heck of a mountain.
Jesus may have been on speed dial, but it wasn't enough. Kentucky won 79-56, and rapper Kendrick Lamar broke Spotify streaming world records this week when he dropped his new album To Pimp a Butterfly early. He calls the album honest, fearful, unapologetic. Final track is the 12-minute-long Mortal Man.
How tough is your skin when they turn you in? Do you show forgiveness? What brush do you bend with dust in your shoulders from being offended? What kind of den did they put you in when the lions start hissing? What kind of bridge did they burn?
We're looking at a week in the news. You can join us. What do you see going on at the University of Virginia? What are you thinking on Downton Abbey Congressman Aaron Schock, on the Jinx millionaire Robert Durst, on March Madness, fraternities, more bad headlines there this week, on Putin in North Korea, on the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Lots of American allies joining over Washington's objections there. Steve is calling from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is a call from a concerned father.
Yes, sir.
My daughter was arrested the other night in Charlottesville at the protest. She was the only arrest that was made, and it had to do, I think, as according to her story, she said that she was alerting the other protesters who were marching peacefully through the streets of Charlottesville.
Now, this is at UVA after the arrest and 10 stitches and all the rest, students upset. Okay, what happened, Steve?
Well, she was walking, and she heard the police officers discussing among themselves that they were just recently authorized to use pepper spray if necessary. So she decided to share that information with some of the other protesters in front of her. One of the officers heard her speaking of this and decided to take it into his own hands, grabbed her from behind, and proceeded to arrest her, which it's kind of, I mean, it's about rules of engagement, I think, more than black-white. I think the police officers in this country are just, they're nervous. I understand it's a difficult job, but they got to play by the rules, too.
What did you think, Steve, before your daughter had this brush with the police, what did you think of the images of the student, Martise Johnson, on the pavement, bleeding, officers all over him? I guess apparently he had tried to get into a bar, didn't have an ID, wasn't 21, but it was a pretty rough handling, it looked like, but I wasn't there.
Familiar with the story that the young man who tried to enter the bar actually had a legitimate license and was asked apparently by the person at the door, what was his zip code? Because a lot of kids who might have a fake license don't know all the details on the license. But he knew it, and for some reason they just refused to let him in. Apparently he looks younger than his age, but it was a legitimate license. And how they handled it, I mean, there are holes in the story and pictures and videos, but with the ability with media today to my daughter's arrest is on Twitter. It's available for anybody to see. And it's just the way these police officers, I know they feel like they're in siege control or something, but it's gotten to be out of control. It's gotten to be, they have to work, they have to play by the rules too. It's not fair for someone to be peacefully protesting, walking down the street, to be accosted by a police officer because she's sharing information with her friends who are also protesting.
Steve, I understand your concern very acutely as a father there, and I appreciate your call. Here's a little sound from the rally. I guess probably the same rally. Drew more than 1,000 students. Martise Johnson spoke there, the one who had all the stitches, the bloodied black UVA honors student. Brought him, was in tears a little bit here, talking with the students, asking that everyone respect each other.
I beg for you guys, regardless of your personal opinions and the way you feel about subjects, to please respect everyone here. We're all part of one community.
And here's UVA President Teresa Sullivan in an interview with WTVR on Wednesday night saying she was deeply disturbed by the arrest, also asked the governor's office to launch an independent investigation.
I felt it in my stomach. I just, seeing the blood run down that young man's face, you know, I wanted to know what happened.
Jack, here we go again. I don't know if it's... unleashing violence more quickly than in the past, or the country's hypersensitized right now, does not want to see this. But, you know, people look at this and say, wait a minute, what's happened? 10 stitches, honor student, his behavior didn't seem that far off the hook, and the response seemed awfully aggressive.
It did, and the officers were not Charlottesville policemen. They were members of the Virginia Department of Alcohol Beverage Control. That's the agency that regulates the alcohol industry in Virginia and operates the government-run liquor stores. And people are saying, wait a minute, we didn't know there was this agency just sort of prowling around in college towns ready to fall on people if they don't have the right ID, or in this case may have had the right ID. And it's just another example of how many of these these police forces, these armed men, do we have in the country, and the celerity with which they seem to turn to force. I mean, you can't miss it. It's not a coincidence. Steve says, "Oh, it's bigger than race. It has to do with their just reaction to being challenged." Yes, true, but it's centrally about race. You just can't miss it. And somehow you have to say that the job of policemen these days seems to select, at least at the margins, for people who are right ready, real quick, to smash down young black people. And that has, and I say that as someone greatly sympathetic to the police, but it can't be denied. And this is a structural problem that effectively denies real freedom to young black men. You can't go high enough. That's what this young man says. He's an honor student. Nothing will protect you if you are young and black and the police want to get after you. They will.
Michael in Boston. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, you should have a show with police officers who come on.
Oh, we certainly have, but what do you think here, Michael?
Well, I mean, a lot of cops have been killed in the line of duty. There are two police officers killed in New York City after the Ferguson case. I mean, we weren't there. You don't know what police have to go through every day.
Do you think they felt their lives were in threat when the charges they brought against him were just belligerence, not even resisting arrest?
It's a tough job.
I agree. So
every stop is a potential stop where you can get killed. And I think it's very unfair how police officers are portrayed in the political correct press. Pretty outrageous.
But what about on the other side of it? I mean, here's an honor student with 10 stitches and blood all over, and it doesn't seem to have been a life-threatening or really dangerous situation. It was kids and the door of a bar.
I wasn't there. You weren't there. We don't know what happened. Just like the woman who called up about her daughter. I mean, as a kid growing up, if you have to, any police officer, black or white, who stops you, you have to be very, very careful of how you move in the car, how you behave. You have to have respect. If you're going to talk back to a person who has a license to kill, then you're not raised properly. You have to be very careful.
Michael, I hear exactly what you're raising. And at the same time, society, I think, needs to be able to look critically at both sides of this, including the police side, and say, are things going right here? I appreciate your call very much. April in Beverly, Massachusetts. April, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd just like to make the comment, and this is coming from the inside, because I know several policemen, my uncle being one, a good cop.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's talking about how the whole environment inside of the ranks is that, you know, you only have 10 or 20% guys that are the, quote, bad cops. But the feeling is that nobody can speak up against them. So you got all these brothers, you know, in uniform who are kind of having to keep quiet to the bad actors. And we keep, you know, recruiting these guys. I don't know how much thought is even taken to, you know, their mentality, a lot of them. I mean, we've got a lot of guys that are, you know, power freaks and are not appropriate. They have a very hard job, but you can't let a few bad guys ruin a potentially very good, you know, organization. And then now, of course, we have all these new laws now. They don't even have to be transparent. You know, police forces are keeping the records now confidential. There should be public records of things they're ranks are doing wrong.
April, I appreciate your call. I want to take the law enforcement and security up a little higher here, if I may. to the Secret Service. More testimony on that front this week after last week's news that drunken Secret Service officers had run into a barrier at the White House. Pretty embarrassing congressional hearings on Tuesday. Secret Service Director Joseph Clancy was there grilled about this latest incident. He was not immediately told of the incident, and he asked for patience from lawmakers as he works, he said, to reform the Secret Service.
It's going to take time to change maybe some of this culture. There's no excuse for this information not to come up the chain. That's going to take time because I'm going to have to build trust with our workforce.
New York Democrat saying there wasn't time. Time isn't the problem here. There's a House Appropriations Committee hearings. Shocked that this culture would go on.
What really shocks me, it will take time to change the culture. I don't understand this one bit. It seems to me it should take time to help people who think this is the culture to go get another job.
Rachel Smolkin, how is this playing in Washington? It does seem kind of incredible. Missing videotape here from this incident. He said, well, it's taped over every 72 hours, but isn't that the whole point? When something happens, you stop it and hang on to it so you can go back and review.
Absolutely. And this has very quickly become yet another black eye for the Secret Service in Washington. No partisan divide here. A lot of recognition that the culture just absolutely needs to change. At the same time, it's important to note that the more discussion there is about this incident, the more cloudy it becomes. So it now appears that the original story that was put out about this incident had some information that was perhaps exaggerated allegations that were not correct. It is not known now if the agents were involved in drinking or if they were not. So while this was certainly not a good moment for the Secret Service and will get a well-deserved scrutiny moving forward, it's also important to note that some of those initial details have now been called into question.
Steve in Lexington, South Carolina. You're on the air, Steve.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
It worries me that we're not taking this problem with the Secret Service seriously enough. And I mean in the executive branch or the legislative branch and its oversight at any level of government, because if they have one lapse too many, we're going to have an assassination, perhaps, of our president. That would shake the foundation of the world. And it troubles me, and troubles me deeply, profoundly. And I just would like to see every branch of government, top to bottom, we've got to change the culture in that agency. It's obvious. Clean house, flush, whatever you got to do, but we've got to get control here. We've got to.
I'm right there with you, Steve. It's just it just seems unforgivable to have anything but the best level of professionalism right there. For heaven's sakes, I appreciate your call, Yoki. A couple of other foreign stories I want to get a look at here. One is Moscow, Putin, and North Korea cozying up a little bit this week. What's going on there, Yoki?
So this was kind of a fun part to a degree. I mean, Vladimir Putin disappeared for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So there were rumors that he had a medical procedure, something had gone wrong in the operating table, plastic surgery perhaps had gone wrong, that there had been a coup in Moscow, that he was dead. He resurfaces. Kim Jong-un occasionally has disappeared, where there have been kind of similar questions, and now the two of them are together in public. The only thing about this that is potentially a silver lining is that Putin is, for all of his many flaws, semi-rational at a minimum, if not fully rational. So the more times you could have a country that we talk to, no matter how frayed, talking to North Korea, the better. Because the more isolated North Korea is, the fewer avenues there are to talk to Kim Jong-un.
So Kim Jong-un coming to Moscow in, what is it, May this year, first time under Putin, a good thing in your view?
I think it is, actually, because we don't want Kim Jong-un sitting in Pyongyang going even more paranoid, even more isolationist than he is. If he can talk, if he can travel, that brings them a teeny little bit out of their shell, and that is for the good.
Here's another one. We've got this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank led by China, seen as a kind of challenge to the World Bank. We've been talking about polarization in Washington. Republicans and Democrats could not get their act together to open up the membership and leadership and investment in the World Bank more widely to some Asian participants. Now China's starting something that may become a real challenge to the World Bank on its own. The White House was upset when Britain joined, a big ally. And this week, Germany, France, Italy also announced that they're going to pile in here. Australia, South Korea now expected to follow. Is the paralysis in Washington and polarization there, Yoki, now at risk of costing the U.S. its leadership position globally?
Unfortunately, I think in a word, yes. You know, when we talk about World Bank, Development Bank, obviously it's a kind of topic that can make one's eyes glaze over, but it really matters. I mean, soft power, one reason why the U.S. has been able to shape a world system that benefits our country, that has been relatively stable since World War II, is because of things like the World Bank. If the World Bank is replaced by a China-dominated bank that doesn't care about corruption, doesn't care about human rights, doesn't care about labor rights, doesn't care about transparency, that upends a system that's functioned pretty well for almost 70 years. This is a big deal. It's not getting as much notice as it should. And the world looks at Washington now on almost every issue, on Iran, where you have Congress trying to directly undercut a president, on an issue like this bank, on an issue like the budgets, pretty much all the things we've talked about, and says Washington is broken. The U.S. is declining, and it's a decline that could be prevented, and that's in some ways heartbreaking.
It just doesn't need to happen. Rachel, what happens at home in our politics matters abroad. Where's the Loretta Lynch nomination stand now? She's up for attorney general, but it's been held up. Dick Durbin saying this week she's been sent to the back of the bus like Rosa Parks. Progress there, Rachel?
No progress. And in fact, it looked like briefly yesterday that perhaps there would be some progress. There were efforts to reach an agreement, bipartisan efforts over this human trafficking bill, which is, of course, not directly related, but has become the thing that's preventing a vote on Loretta Lynch for AG.
Jack Beatty, it's something to watch here on how many fronts we can be practically paralyzed at the same time.
And even on fronts where they agree, as on human trafficking paralysis.
Let us break through somehow. Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. We're grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for joining us, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
Yoki Driesen, managing editor for News for Foreign Policy. Yoki, always great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack Beatty, thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. See you there. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.